waiting for?
Let's stop this pussy footing around. Right?
All right. Greetings from Jindal. This is Jody Havnot. You're listening to Strange Ways Podcast, and I'm super excited. I'm here with the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. J.R. Smalling. How you doing, J.R.?
Great, man.
All the KISS fans out there know exactly who you are, from the, you know, the intro of Alive to just running around with KISS. You know, I mean, you're pretty much a famous guy. It's pretty cool, and I'm really honored to have you on the show, man. Thanks for doing it.
Hey, listen, man, the honor is mine. You know, it's a wonderful thing that after all these decades, really, jeez, I can't believe I even said that, but,
right.
You know, after all these decades that the real fans, the people that make shit happen, that they care. And, you know, on behalf of the rest of the original crew and myself, I want to thank you and the fans for keeping us in your thoughts and in your minds, man, because really, you guys, you know, keep us going.
Right on, man. And I think it's because, I mean, you guys played such an important part in the, you know, the creation of what became the monster we know as KISS. You were there from the beginning.
And Absolutely.
Yeah, and so speaking of being there from the beginning, JR, I'm sure everyone out there knows about it, but he's a co-author of this brand new ebook called, what's it called, JR?
Out on the Streets.
Hell yeah, a great title. Is it kind of Out on the Streets for a Living type of reference or what?
Well, yeah,
that's
exactly
what I got from it.
Exactly, you know, we gave 2.5 years of our lives, 2.5 years of blood, sweat, and tears, and woke up one morning to find that we were out in the streets. But for the 99% of the time that happened before that day, shit was wonderful, man.
That's great. I got a million questions about the early days for you, but before we get into all that, I just want to make sure that everyone knows to go to theoriginalkisscrew.com. That's with a K.
KISS Crew, right. Crew with a K.
That's where you can pick up the ebook, and what it is it comes out monthly, correct? It's like a series, like a serial.
It comes out monthly. This particular publishing format was very popular
Right. Years
and years ago. A lot of famous books that we know, In Cold Blood, Truman Capote, was originally published in this format. And what it does for us, it allows us to respond to various questions directly from fans that we might not have otherwise put in the book. In other words, we could spend a year or more writing our thoughts and our views and our feelings and completely miss some of the basic questions that we get from people like yourself.
Right.
So rather than dictate to everybody, we want to open it up and make everybody a part of this whole process so that when they close this book, at the end of the book, they will know that effort has been put into answering their questions and not just preaching to them.
I think that's great. I think that's what the fans want and deserve. You know, we've all heard, you know, just the sloganeering all through the years, and no one really tells the absolute truth. You know what I'm saying? And,
yeah.
Finally, we'll get that from you guys, and I love it, man. I think it's really
there
cool.
There you go, man. You know, the truth is stranger than fiction, bro.
Right.
And you're all going to get the truth. That's for sure. I guarantee you that.
Hell yeah. And each episode's like $3.50, right? $3.50.
Yeah.
$3.50.
You can't
beat
it. You can't beat it. It's like a great magazine monthly. You know, it's great.
Yeah, you know, for the price of a cup of Starbucks.
Right.
You know, you can walk down memory lane and get some of the answers to some of the questions that you've had all along, and then find out some stuff that you didn't know in the first place.
Right. It's great.
We're thinking we're going to do one of these a month or so until we've published the entire book in e-format. And once that's all done, we're going to put all of these e-editions together, bind them in a hardcover book, and release that along with some never-before-seen photos, memorabilia, and other bonus material that I can't really tell you about because everybody's gonna love it, but I can't blow it, man. Stay tuned.
I'm a fan of waiting in anticipation for things that I love, so I dig it.
There you go.
And I'm sure you got a ton of really great photos, obviously, you know, from back in the day.
Well, you know, it's funny. The photos that we have are photos that are forwarded to us by friends and fans.
Right.
You know, when you're out on the road and you're doing your thing, especially doing a thing with a group like Kiss, and especially in the early days, we didn't have a minute to breathe or sleep, much less take a picture. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
So what we've got, you know, is stuff that has been bought, purchased, or otherwise, you know, forwarded to us by friends that were around and were backstage and behind the scenes. That, you know, I get stuff all the time. Oh man, you won't believe, I was going through this, and I found this. Bang.
Right.
Perfect. Never seen the light of day before until now.
That's great.
Yeah, man.
Good memories for you, I'm sure, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, working for Kiss, and I've worked for a lot of bands, but at that point in my life, working for Kiss was the closest thing that you could get to, like, you know, running away from home and joining the circus.
Totally. You know?
It was everything that any guy could want. You get to blow shit up. You get to see the world. You have a never-ending supply of some of the finest ladies around.
Oh, hell yeah.
And you make great friends in the guys that you meet along the way. So
right.
It was really a great trip. Great trip.
That's awesome. One thing I wanted to touch on was just your personal history, because you and I have went back and forth on Facebook quite a bit, and I just think it's so cool that you ran around with Dust, man. And Marky,
yeah,
can you talk
sure.
a little bit about that for us?
For sure. Well, you know, and it's funny that you mention that, because that is that's covered in the first edition that's available for purchase right now.
Right on.
My involvement with Dust started when my family moved to the Flatbush section in Brooklyn. My parents owned a big house, and they allowed me to bring in all of my friends to rehearse and jam and play music in the basement. And Dust was a rival band to the group that I was playing in.
Wow.
And it was always very good natured, and I mean, we weren't, you know, it wasn't a cutthroat kind of vibe, you know.
No, it was a scene, man.
Yeah, it was a scene, exactly, man. We were loving it. It was you know, the late 60s, the summer of love, hippies, sex and drugs and rock and roll. And and we were young guys that were making the most of it. But what happened was, my group, we suffered a catastrophic fire at the house that we were renting upstate.
Oh no!
And in an effort to stay in the business and earn enough money to buy a new set of drums and get cracking again, I started working for Dust, who in the meantime had recorded their first album for Kama Sutra Records.
Right.
And the first album came out, it did moderately well.
They were actually played here in St. Louis, like, in heavy rotation, man.
I know, I was going to say, you guys in St. Louis and Cleveland, apparently are the only two cities in the country that have any real rock and roll cred.
Right on.
Now, you guys are on it. You were on Kiss from the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
You were on Dust from the very beginning, so much so that when requests to have Dust perform in St. Louis and in Cleveland and a few other places, they couldn't do that because they had never performed outside of New York City.
Right.
So that's when I came along, and it seemed like a perfect thing. I was a drummer. I knew Mark. Obviously, I knew how to set up the drums and take care of my drums. Yeah, so when Dust got the gigs, Like I say, my drums had just been lost in the fire. Perfect opportunity for me to stay in the business with people that I knew.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, Marky was your rival, right?
Marky, I got to tell you, Marky really had no rivals. Even at
Dude, yeah, he's a monster, brother.
He is outrageous. Okay?
He was like Bonham meets Ginger Baker meets like Keith Moon.
Mark was Mitch Mitchell on steroids.
Right.
Okay?
That's perfect.
He was the fastest, the most precise.
Still is.
The most heavy hitting guy ever. And if you're familiar with Dust, you know, their catchphrase was 30 incredible fingers.
Right.
You know?
And it couldn't be more true.
Oh, man. Every one of those guys were just ridiculous. Kenny Aronson, bass player, Richie Wise on guitar.
Right.
They played so fast. And I would encourage anybody that's not familiar with Dust, go on YouTube.
Oh, yeah. Definitely check them out.
Check out Dust, man. You'll be blown away. Those guys, this is already 42 years after their first album came out. And that stuff is still strong.
Plus, for any Ramones heads, it's cool to see Marky do something totally different because
Sure. He
plays very basic in the Ramones, you know? But then on Dust, he's going like completely apeshit all the time. It's awesome.
He's a monster. He's a monster. I wasn't any real competition for him technically, but what I had, I had a great funk vibe.
Right.
I had a great kick drum and great syncopation, and I could hold my own with that. But technically, the hand skills, forget about it. Mark was the man.
Right. People can actually hear you playing drums on a lot of Kiss demos.
Over the course of 2 days back in 75, we recorded.
You did Don't You Hesitate. That's you, isn't it?
Don't You Hesitate. I did God of Thunder, the original fast version.
Yeah, with the kind of 16ths on the hi-hat.
Yeah, that's cool. And it's funny because people talk to me and say, well, that sounded kind of disco, you know?
Right.
And it wasn't really supposed to be disco. What I was hearing in my mind was a little Ian Pace there from Deep Purple.
That's what I always thought, like Smoke on the Water.
Well, thank you for getting it.
Right.
Because you'd be amazed at some of the comments that I got.
I bet.
But I played on that, and I'm very, very proud to say that I was the first person to play Detroit Rock City.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I played on the demo for Detroit Rock City the first time that it was ever laid down on tape. And so those songs, plus 12 others, we recorded, like I say, over the course of a couple of days. And, you know, we know the ones that remained intact, and then some of the other songs got cut in half and joined with other songs, et cetera, et cetera. But
right.
You have the opportunity to listen to those 15 songs. You'll hear a lot of stuff that was later, you know, augmented and changed into different stuff.
Yeah, but some of those demos are better than the actual studio versions, I think. I really do, man. I'm not just saying that.
You said it, not me, man. You know, it's funny because the way that came up, we had just come off of a particularly long extended leg of whatever tour it was on. I can't even think of them as tours really, because it was nonstop. Those first 2.5 years, the first year alone, we did over 200 one-nighters.
Right.
So you figure 200 one-nighters, plus the time being in the studio, plus the time that we spent actually getting to the gigs.
Right.
You know, we were occupied with this at least two out of every 3 days. Probably more, you know. So it was really a whirlwind blitzkrieg kind of thing, and it was wonderful. But we came in off the road. We were supposed to have a couple of weeks off. We didn't get it because management had been angling to try to get Bob Ezrin to produce the next album.
Right.
And Bob didn't really. He was very happy at the top of the world with Alice Cooper and whatever else he was doing, and he knew nothing about the band. He said, "Well, look. Get me some demos. I'll listen to it. My window is very short. If I like them, we'll work together." Peter wasn't available, and the band knew that I could play somewhat, even though the stuff that you're hearing I hadn't played, you know, in probably about two or three years at least. I hadn't played more than once or twice a year in that period.
Still sounds great, bro.
Thank you, man.
Super
thank
solid.
You, yeah. Yeah. But you know, they needed somebody to lay it down. It's before drum machines, you know.
Yeah, way before.
And they needed somebody that was kind of in the camp, so to speak, that would come in, do this work, and not, you know, screw them around or stick them up for however much money or, you know,
keep
the secret, so to speak. So I went in as a sideman, kind of. And really, the songs were recorded like, okay, here are the chords. Got it? Okay, great. Roll tape. Take one. Boom. And we recorded no more than two takes on every song. Of course, I didn't know where the verses were. I didn't know where the breaks were. So a lot of my playing is just that. You know, it's a studio drummer sitting in, keeping the beat so that the big boys can do their thing, you know, afterwards in the overdubs.
Right.
But I'd like to think that if I had the opportunity to work with them for a little bit, the performances could have even been better. But hey, it is what it is, man. And I was happy to be there.
Right. I've always honestly thought Don't You Hesitate was one of the best songs they never released, you know? They should have, I think.
Yeah, yeah. There were some good songs on there. Don't You Hesitate was cool. Mad Dog wasn't bad, you know. But, you know, it's obvious by the songs that came immediately after that, being Detroit Rock City and God of Thunder.
Right.
Those songs just stood out head and shoulders above everything else.
Oh, yeah. They're still playing them today, you know.
There you go. Yeah, it's great. For sure.
I got another question for you if you're up for a question. But, you know, I'm from St. Louis. And around here, it's like almost like a mythical story of the time in 74 when you guys came to do the Casey Kite Fest.
Do
you remember anything about it?
I remember that it was nothing like what we had ever done before.
Yeah, supposedly at the time, it was like one of the biggest shows you guys have done because there was like 40,000 people there. And this was like 2 weeks into your first tour.
Yeah, it was the biggest thing that we did at the time. A couple of things with that. First of all, it was the first outdoor gig that we did.
Right.
It was the first daytime show that we did.
Those pictures are really wild looking.
Yeah, man. I mean, it was that gig kind of sums up the way those first couple of years of working with Kiss went, you know?
Yeah.
It was an opportunity, and these guys took it, grabbed it by the balls, and just rocked their socks off, and the crowd loved it. And that pretty much set the tone for everything that we did after that. You know, it's like, well, if you can blow into town, you know, in a daytime gig with no lights, you're pretty much unknown. Half of your effects you don't have,
right.
And obviously they're a very effect-heavy, you know, effects-driven band.
Right.
You can rock the crowd with that. You know what? This might work. And sure enough, it did, man.
I recently did an interview with Mark Close from the radio station KC that brought you guys in. So he was telling me about it. He told me that you guys flew in. He met you guys at the airport, and he said he took you down to a hotel, and then that you guys needed 80,000 watts of power, and all he had was four Honda generators offering 4,000. And he said that he goes, I don't know his name, but this big black dude that was working for him was like wigging out on me and shit. I'm like, this got to be JR, you know?
Yeah.
He goes, dude, he told me that you were like, fuck it, we just won't play unless you get us enough power. And then, so he went and tried to get a couple more generators and couldn't, and came back. And then he talked to you and he said that you guys were like, you know what? This is too big of a show to pass up. We're going to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I always just thought it was cool. Do you remember any of that at all?
Yeah, sure. You know,
obviously it was 40 years ago, but still.
It's 40 years ago, but you know, some things you remember, you know,
right. Forever.
And that gig was one of them. The 80,000 watts, I don't know, you know, that about that number, but
right.
You know, just going by what was the norm for us in even a smaller indoor venue. You know, the technical requirements were barely met for that outdoor gig, like you say, before 40,000 people. So we were really concerned with having, you know, amplification and everything, every nuance being able to be, you know, picked up and amplified to the crowd.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of like, if you ever watched the Beatles when they performed at Shea Stadium, you know?
Yeah, and they're playing through, like, just the house PA. Can't hear anything.
Yeah, you can't hear a note. But you can look at the crowd. You can look at the faces of the band members. And you can feel the electricity that's coming off that stage and being shared with the audience. And that's the way it was at that gig. You know, yeah, man, it was great stuff. Great stuff.
That's awesome. So what was it actually like? I mean, you guys were going town to town in the early days. And no one, in a lot of places, people really didn't know who Kiss was. And it's like you got to see the transformation of these people from not knowing them until, like, having witnessed the greatest band ever. What was it like for you? Was it cool?
You know what? It was almost not fair because we knew what was about to happen.
Right.
You know, we knew that these four guys were going to take the stage and grab the audience by the balls and not let them go until they were ready.
Hell yeah.
Know? And that's basically what it was. It was a very daunting task. It was a hard gig. I'm not going to tell you that it wasn't.
Right.
You know, in the early going, there was three of us in the crew. And we're very proud to say that and to know that basically the same show that the three of us put up 40 years ago is, for all intents and purposes, the same show that they have now.
Hell yeah. And you guys did it with three people.
We did it with three people. You know, it's bigger now. It's flashier now. Of course, they have more money. The drums can go up higher.
Right.
They can afford more amps. The costumes are nicer, everything else. But it's the same flash pods, fog machines, flaming columns, confetti cannons. Gene's still blowing his flames. The drums are still levitating. Those are things that we did each and every night. We found a way to make that happen. And at the end of every set, the response was the same. It was like holding somebody's head underwater at the pool. and the look on their face once they finally broke the surface and were able to take a breath of air. That's what it was like when Kiss left the stage, man. People were just knocked the hell out, and we loved it.
Hell yeah, I still love it.
Yeah, for sure, man.
It's just so cool. Let me ask you this too. This is one thing that's always in going around in Kiss circles. You know how it's, you know, it was Gene and Paul's band from the beginning, and Ace and Peter were just hired guns. But did they actually seem like a band when you guys were touring around in the early days, or did it seem like that Ace and Peter were just hired dudes?
No, they were a band.
That's what I thought, man.
They were a band. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, Peter was actually the mouthpiece for the band in the early going.
Yeah, you can hear that on, like, some of those early tapes from, like,
Daisy.
Yeah.
But Paul was groomed to take that role over, and you know, rightfully so. I think
definitely
to have a front person that is anchored behind a set of drums is not really doing the best for the audience, who is feeding off of energy and movement and everything else.
Right.
You know, but in the early going, they were a band. And you ask about what it was like, you know, when you're traveling around and everyone around you is wearing leather and denim and, you know, 4 or 5 inch platform heels, and you stick out like a sore thumb wherever you go. You know, we were all that we had to depend on.
Yes.
Right.
The four guys in the band, Sean Delaney, and the three guys in the crew, it was us against the world. We were the truck drivers. We were the security guys. We were the special effects crew. We were the carpenters. We were the wardrobe people. We were the makeup. I mean, you know, we did everything. And I like to say that, you know, To be a KISS crew member back in the early 70s was like being in the Army, and that blurb that they say, we did more as a crew before noon than most crews did all day.
Hell yeah, dude.
That's the truth, man.
Right. You know? How do you feel knowing that, you know, you guys or basically respond. You know, like any concert you go to now is basically a Kiss ripoff as far as their show with the flames and all the explosions and everything. What do you feel knowing that you guys were the ones who basically invented that? Is that so cool or what?
I think it's great.
I think it is too, man, and you should be proud of it.
Yeah, I'm very proud of it. Are you kidding? It's a testament to our work ethic and who we were. You know, there were nights when we had to scale the show back a little bit, especially in the beginning with smaller venues. You know, sometimes the drums couldn't go up 7 feet in the air, you know, but we found a way to make them go up 4 or 5.
Right.
So sometimes the ceiling was so low that we couldn't use those flaming columns, you know, the way that they have been used, shooting flames up, you know, 40 feet in the air now, you know.
Right.
But it was about knowing that, learning how to tailor fit that show into every venue that we went into. And we got it right 99.9% of the time.
Right.
And it's really great to see now a lot of those things. And it's wonderful to think that, like I say, you know, a three-man crew did the job of what's now done by, 40, 50 people might be out there.
Who knows? Yeah.
You know, totally. It's great, man.
Yeah, it's totally cool.
Yep.
Let me ask you this, man. There's always all these stories. I know I'm probably sounding like a Kiss fanboy, and I totally am. I can't deny it. But it's just so cool to hear it from the original guys, man.
Yes.
But I want to know, we always hear all these stories about you guys locking other tour managers in, like, anvil cases. I mean, could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, everybody knows the story of the of Argent's guy.
Right.
Solomon, whatever his last name was. See, what you got to remember is we were, still are, you know, New Yorkers.
Hell yeah.
And everybody knows what the New York vibe is. So, either you love us or you hate us.
Right.
But when we leave, you will know that we were there. You know? And that's the way we dealt with everything. We got along with everybody. Unless you proved that we shouldn't get along with you, and then you were screwed, basically. And that's just where it's at, man. We didn't allow anybody to roll over, and we had a little ace up our sleeve as well, if you pardon the pun, because after the first couple of months, and it became known that it didn't make a difference who their headliner was, Kiss was selling most of the tickets.
Right.
You know, so. After we had our way with whatever headlining road crew that we had to, then the promoter would come in and say, whatever you guys need, you know, you're doing your thing, go ahead, rock the house.
Right.
And by the end of the show, whether you loved us or you hated us, you knew that you saw something that had never been seen before. And it was an accomplishment to get that show up and running, and people really appreciated us for that, and that, like I say, is really much appreciated by everybody in the crew up till this day.
Right on, man. We, as a Kiss Army, man, I just want to say for all of us, thank you guys so much for doing that, man. You know, we wouldn't have had it without you guys. You know,
hey man, thank you. It's because of folks like you that give us the inspiration to do that. You know, if we went out and people were kind of ho-hum about it and all,
right.
I think we'd have done a lot of soul-searching and, you know, to see what the heck we were doing, you know?
Yeah.
But we believed in what we were doing, and then seeing the reaction on the faces of the fans like yourself, that validated everything. That let us know that, you know, there was value in what we were doing, even though we were lowly crew members.
Right.
Great stuff, man.
Let me ask you this too, man. I know you're probably getting tired of my questions, but man, I just got to know.
It's all good.
So everyone knows you're the classic voice at the beginning of Kiss Alive, you know?
Yeah.
And you wrote that bit, but what was it like, you know, at the time when you guys had recorded that? I mean, Kiss still wasn't very big. I mean, they were starting to be, but you know, everyone knows Alive is the record that blew them up.
So sure.
How did you feel knowing that, A, you know, it's the band that you pushed, and B, you're on the record, and how did you feel when it started to really, you know, blow up? What did you think?
Well, you know, it's funny because the intro came about, the original intro was done by Sean Delaney, who I affectionately and with no reservations call the fifth member of KISS. He was the man. KISS was his brainchild, and anybody that was around in those days know it.
Oh yeah.
Whether or not certain people admit it is one thing, you know, but it's really the truth. Right. Sean was brilliant. His intro was admittedly, it was a little bit soft. It was whatever, for example, your town. Hey, St. Louis, you ready to rock? Well, if you are, put your two lips together and kiss.
Right.
You know, and that was okay. But when you're opening up for guys like Blue Oyster Cult, and, you know, they're literally 9-10 inches shorter than you are, and they come out and their intro is, all right, you dogs, on your feet or on your knees.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, I don't think that KISS shit is going to hold up, you know? We got to come a little bit stronger than that.
Hell
we
yeah.
had the first thing that anybody hears out of anyone from KISS's mouth has to be as strong as what they're about to see.
That's it.
And, you know, you may have heard the story. There was a commercial on TV that was very popular. It was a Toyota commercial.
I don't know if I've heard that one.
Yeah, it was a Toyota commercial, and the jingle was, you ask for it, you got it, Toyota. And at the same time, the Hotter Than Hell album came out.
Right.
So you asked for it, you got it, Hotter Than Hell, Heat, Hot, you had, and I came up with, you wanted the best and you got it, the hottest band in the land. And what was great was I did that intro from off stage right, usually Gene's side of the stage.
Right.
And, you know, the band goes out, like every band still does to this day. They walk out on stage, they plug in, they tune up, and then they look to whatever side the announcement's coming from, and they give a nod like, yeah, it's ready. We're ready, you know?
Right.
And after I did that intro the first couple of times, you could see how the band was getting pumped, knowing that that was coming, much less the audience, I mean, you know. But to look into Paul's eyes, being the first chords, he playing the first chords on Deuce,
right?
You know, and as each word's coming out of my mouth, you could see his eyes getting bigger and bigger. You could see him just growing in stature on stage. You know,
that's so cool.
And that to me those were some moments that we could never get back again, because those guys, they tried, they worked so hard. The crew worked so hard for that little bit of 35 minutes or whatever that they got
right.
as an opening act. And it was like, you know, just ready to burst. All of this energy and excitement was just ready to burst. And that intro, I think, hyped up not only the audience, but the band, and really set the stage for what the next 35 minutes was going to be about.
Man, that is fucking awesome, bro.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
And I could totally see Paul and anyone getting hyped as you're saying it, because I get hyped just hearing it, you know, 40 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it was their thing, you know. It wasn't, well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Please give a nice, warm St. Louis welcome to, you know.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, yeah.
And anybody that's listening, if you've got any juice at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, get in touch with those guys. Tell them to start a wing or an award for iconic rock and roll introductions, because there are some great ones, starting with, ladies and gentlemen, the Rolling Stones.
Right.
That's all I have to say. You know,
right.
Anything, any other way that a Rolling Stones concert is started, it's not the Stones. Any other way that a KISS concert is started without that intro, it's not the same, you know?
Amen.
So, yeah, give me a vote of confidence here. Maybe I can get a picture of me.
Hell yeah. You deserve it. You totally deserve it.
Good stuff, man. Really, it was great. It was, you know, it was, everybody were young guys, early 20s, young, dumb, and full of cum, as they say, you know what I mean?
Hell yeah.
Just testosterone up the wazoo, and that 35 minutes on stage allowed everybody to get their yayas out, if you will.
Oh yeah.
There and that's what we did, man. And it was great. It was great.
Yes,
it was. The crew was involved in every minute of stage action, because it was the first band that had, you know, actual stage cues
right.
that had to be hit perfectly in time with the band. You know, this wasn't about, you know, bringing out an acoustic guitar and swapping off guitars with guys. And oh, by the way, this guy's in the crew. You know, we were doing things. We were setting off bombs in sync with the music. We were dropping dry ice and creating fog. You know, at the proper time, we were the guys that were making the drums levitate at the right time. We were the guys that were making sure that Gene had his flaming dagger and his mouth full of kerosene to blow those flames. Always with the fire extinguisher standing by, you know, for the few times that he did, you know, catch his hair on fire, that kind of thing. So this was not, it wasn't just your typical road crew that was humping gear and tuning guitars, you know.
Right.
That really a very small part of who we were and what we did. And we took pride in that.
Hell yeah. One thing I was kind of curious about is, you know, how did it all end for you? You know, I know you went on to do plenty of really cool things, but how did you decide to quit working with Kiss?
Well, it's easy to decide to quit once you've been fired. You know, that decision was made for me and the rest of the original crew. And without getting too much into detail, it came as a total shock out of the blue. Some of us still haven't fully recovered from it, to be perfectly honest with you. I know I still have my feelings about it. Because it wasn't a crew working for a band, you know?
Yeah, you guys were like a family, man, like a gang.
We were exactly right. We were everything. We were co-workers. We were friends. We were family. We looked after those guys like they were our own brothers. No harm ever came to them when we were around.
Right.
And that's attested in the fact that there are no pictures of the group without makeup while we were around.
You guys used to take the film and shit, right?
We did what we had to do.
Hey.
You can only tell somebody don't take a picture so many times, and after that, then you take it for them, right?
Right. Hey, man, you got to do what you got to do.
So, yeah, it's keeping that mystique. It's keeping that thing, you know.
Right.
Like I say, the book is 99.9% warm and fuzzy, great stuff, great stories. But there is a certain part of it that comes at the end, when we were put out on the streets.
Man, oh man. So, and I mean, everything's going good. You're on the Destroyer tour, and then they just fired you guys for what? If you don't mind me asking.
Well, I don't mind you asking if you don't mind me saying. You'll have to wait for the book, man. you'll have to wait for the book.
Hear that out there, Kiss Army? You got to get this book.
You got to get it.
Kiss Crew.
You got to get
out
it.
On the streets.
And like I say, let me say a couple of things here. First of all, please, anybody got any questions, any comments, go ahead to our Facebook page, The Original Kiss Crew. Here again, crew with a K. You want to join up, you know, friend us. We'll be happy to accept you as a member. Post your questions, you know, any clarifications, anything like that. If we don't do it online, perhaps we'll do it in the book. But this is about answering as many questions from the people that made Kiss as possible. This is not about dumping on anybody or sour grapes or anything like that. This is the truth, and that's where it's at.
Hell yeah, it is.
You know, to get some information on purchasing this book, you can go to our website, www.theoriginalkisscrew.com. It'll give you a lot of information on the book, and it has links directly to purchase. One thing that I will point out is also that we've opened up the designing of the hardcover book cover to the fans.
Yeah.
So basically, anyone that thinks that they've got a great idea that fits in with the theme out on the streets and the like, that thinks that they've got a great idea for what this book cover should look like, post it on our Facebook page and see how many likes it gets. And whoever posts the proposed cover that gets the most likes, that's the one that we're going to go with. I mean, you guys are the fans. You deserve the opportunity to have a say in this. You know,
yeah.
post your suggestions. And I have to say, it can't be anything that Kiss has a copyright to. It can't be their logo. It can't be them in makeup or out of makeup. It can't be anything that might make us liable to lawsuit from the powers that be. But at the same point in time, having said that, we've all seen these other books and how those things have been kind of bypassed. So keep it in mind. And whoever comes up with the winning book cover idea, we will give them personally 10 copies of the bound published book, complete with the pictures, complete with this bonus material that I can't tell you about. Each book will be signed individually by Moose, by Rick Monroe, and myself. And you guys can take them and do whatever you like. And, of course, we will also give you credit as being the artist who designed the book cover. So there you go.
Hey, you heard it from JR, Kiss Army. Get on that. Make him a cool cover, man. Get your little
blow it
shout
out
on his book. It's going to be a great book, and everyone's going to love it. And I love that you're doing it in little installments too, man. It's cool.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Good stuff. Thank you.
No problem. I got another question for you if you got time.
Yeah, sure, man.
I can go all day. But did you have like a particular favorite member when you guys were running around back in the day? I mean, were you closer to Paul or Ace, or you know what I'm saying?
You know, asking one of the original crew who their favorite crew member is kind of like asking a parent who their favorite kid is.
Right.
You know? In those days, everybody was extremely cool.
Right.
Everybody was extremely thrilled to be on this ride to fame and fortune. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
And each artist or each member, you know, they had their own different things to bring to the table. You know.
Yeah.
Peter and I were both from Brooklyn. You know, so we had a lot of these and those and dems and you know that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Peter was a very street smart guy.
Right.
And I'd spend my time on the street, so we got along really well on that level. Ace, of course, was the Ace Curly. he loved even those days, you know, to share a laugh and a beer, and you know, when Ace was around, there was never a dull moment. You know, Gene was the intellectual, a wannabe intellectual from his background, having taught and things like that. And
right.
and usually most people that Gene met, he could talk rings around.
Yeah.
You know, I'm proud to say that Gene and I, we had a lot in common, and we were able to communicate on a lot of things that he couldn't communicate on with a lot of other people.
Right.
And it's interesting, we had so much in common, and here again, not to give away too much, but this is in the first chapter of the book also. Gene's mother's name is Florence.
Yeah.
My mother's name is Florence. Gene's birthday is August 25th. My birthday is August 26th.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So the little things like that, when you're meeting people for the first time, it kind of helps form a little bond there. And
yeah.
I think that kind of helped us get a little bit closer. Paul was admittedly very quiet. He was the quietest one. And he was seemed to be most focused on, you know, always writing songs. And, you know, after shows, people would be out. Gene would be, you know, hounding chicks. And, you know, Peter and Ace would be doing their thing. And Paul would always be in his room writing and rewriting and doing that kind of thing. So what you see is what you get. Once they put the makeup on, their alter egos could come out and allow them to be the people that they were under the skin.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
and Gene, from being very soft-spoken and intellectual, became this very outgoing, gregarious, you know, demon.
Yeah.
You know? Paul, from being very quiet and soft-spoken, he became the lover. He became the front man. He's the guy that all the focus is on, Paul.
It's all about Paul.
You know, Ace, he might as well have been, he was always the same on stage or off. He was in a fog, man, you know. but when it was time for him to rip it up and play those solos, he was literally on another world.
Hell yeah, spot on.
You know, for sure. And Peter, you know, very typical of a cat, had moments where he'd love you one minute and he could hate you the next. You know what I mean? But underneath it all, he was a very sweet guy. They were all great, great guys. I don't know what's happened in the meantime. You know, I see what's going on in a lot of these online things and feuds and this and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Those aren't the guys that I know. I never would have worked for a group that the members act like some of them are acting now.
Right.
You know, and there's a part of me that kind of has a little regret that it had to turn out that way, you know?
Yeah.
But it is what it is, and life goes on, no skin off of my nose.
Right.
You know what I mean? But those memories, man, you can't take the memories, and those 2.5 years were pivotal in the growth of KISS. And me personally, as an individual, knowing that I helped to put together something, and at the time I didn't know, but I thought that we were putting something together that was going to last a lifetime, and sure enough, here it is.
40 years later, still talking about it.
Yeah, man.
It's great.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's really cool. Do you have a particular favorite KISS song? Or record or anything like that?
Not really. You know, I haven't listened. The only song that I've ever heard in its entirety after we were let go was Beth.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, you know, you get put out on the streets. It's like,
yeah,
I can't
like,
even
fuck these dudes.
I can't even listen to this anymore. You know, this is, you know.
I'd probably feel the same way if I was in your shoes.
When they got into their disco era and stuff like that, I was so disappointed, you know, that they thought that they had to fall into step with what was going on, because
right.
They never did. They were the trendsetters, you know.
Yeah, and then the next thing you know, they're following others.
Yeah, like everybody else, it was a little disappointing, but glad that they got back to basics, so to speak, and you know, it's all good.
Right.
I gotta think that I think if I had to pick one, I mean, Detroit Rock City holds a fun place in my heart because, like I said, I was the first drummer to play that.
Hell yeah!
And to see what kind of response and what kind of recognition it got for them, that was great. But I gotta tell you. Deuce for me, maybe because of the intro,
right?
But certainly because of seeing the looks on the fans' faces.
Oh, yeah.
The first time they saw KISS on stage with Deuce as an opening number, I mean, everybody's jaw was on the floor, their eyes were like dishes so big. For me, Deuce was a Deuce was great. I loved the moves, the little dance moves.
Hell yeah,
and all of that.
The Deuce moves.
Yeah, yeah. Classic. Sean Delaney strikes again. Man.
Right. What did you think when KISS took the makeup off? Would you think it was a good move or a bad one?
You know what? By that point in time, I didn't really give a shit, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you were doing, I think, Cameo probably at that time, huh?
Around
83 or something.
Yeah, 83. I was just finishing up with Cameo, getting ready to go to work for Michael Jackson and the Jacksons.
Oh, really? I didn't know you worked with the Jacksons.
You didn't know that? Come on,
cool.
Man. That was major stuff. Briefly, once I got fired from KISS, I worked with Angel for a while.
I love Angel.
Yeah, Angel being the antithesis of KISS. KISS in all black and you know.
Musically, though, a lot more progressive, you know.
Absolutely, and certainly, you know, skill-wise, they were much better players. as great a player and stylist as Ace is, Punky Meadows was phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenal. Barry Brandt, the drummer, was just too heavy. You know, Frank Domino, his voice, Greg Giuffrie on keyboards, Mick Jones, those guys were great. Those guys were great. And I thought that, you know, well, great. So I helped make Kiss Kiss. Now I'm with Angel. I'm going to help make Angel Angel, but for whatever reason, they didn't happen.
Right.
After I worked with Angel, I went to work for a company called Libra Krebs. And Libra Krebs managed Aerosmith at the time. They managed Ted Nugent. They managed Scorpions and Golden Earring. They were the U.S. managers for AC/DC.
Right on.
They managed George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic. And I worked with all of those bands in various capacities, again, for, you know, 3 years or more.
Right.
I left them. I got involved with Dr. John, worked with Dr. John. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you said, I started working with some black acts. I worked with Evelyn Champagne King, Cheryl Lynn, a couple of number one female vocalists at the time, the Jacksons.
That one really blows my mind. I hadn't heard about the Jacksons.
Yeah, man. That
was that when they did, like, the reunion tour that they had?
That was the last tour.
Victory Tour, whatever it was.
Victory Tour, yeah, 1984.
Dude.
And at the time, shit, that's 30 years ago. Oh, my God.
That had to be some ridiculous amounts of crowds, right?
That was crazy. We did predominantly 3 shows a week, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, in one town. So we'd go to St. Louis or wherever it was. Right. We'd do, you know, we'd set up shop for a week, you know, which is unheard of.
Right, at least you only have to load, you know, in and out once, though, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, we had 2 stages. So while the while we're performing in whatever city it is, the stage is already under construction in next week's city.
Right.
So then when we tore down from the gig that we just had, all the equipment went in certain trucks, and that went to that city, and then the staging and the rigging and everything else, that leapfrogged and bypassed the next city and went to the city after that. So it was really a logistical, I don't want to say nightmare, but it was a logistical challenge. And for me at that point in time, I wasn't the tour manager and I wasn't the production manager. I was actually hired by Pepsi Cola. I was the marketing manager on that tour.
Wow.
So anytime it was my responsibility to make sure that wherever you look that you saw Pepsi. Right. Yeah, brand awareness, as it's called.
Right. So let me ask you this real quick.
Sure.
So you were working with the Jacksons and Pepsi. Were you around at the time when Michael's hair went up in flames and shit?
No, because that was recorded on a soundstage.
Okay, cool.
That was not part of any live event or anything else. It was funny because that, I don't know if you heard the story, but when that happened, the guy that actually saved Michael was a guy named Miko Brando.
Okay.
And Miko was one of Marlon Brando's sons.
Really?
Yeah.
Small, trippy world.
Yeah, Miko and Michael were good friends. And you know, it's funny because I mentioned that Simmons was the 25th of August, I'm the 26th. If I'm not mistaken, I think Michael was August 27th.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm in the middle of this triumvirate here, birth-wise. But that's good company, I think. It's good company, man. So we did that tour all across the U.S. and Canada. And after that, I worked with a couple other black groups, Midnight Star and a group called Atlantic Star, had a very big song called Secret Lovers.
I remember that song.
Yeah, it was a huge song. And then they followed that up with an even bigger song called Always, which became like the wedding song, you know, for I Will Still Be Yours, bro. Right. You know, that kind of thing. After I worked with them, I got involved with some Japanese promoters, did a lot of concert promotion in Japan and Korea. Promoted my own shows in the West Indies with groups like Third World and Maxi Priest and a bunch of others. I managed Harry Belafonte's company for a while. Anybody that knows Harry Belafonte?
Yeah.
mega entertainer from the started in the 50s and still active to this day.
Right.
I was, that for me was a very fulfilling gig, because I had grown up seeing Harry Belafonte, you know, walking and marching with Martin Luther King,
right,
and the like, and he was a very well known face in the black community then, so to work for him was really, actually that was the best tour that I ever worked on.
That's great.
He had the red UN passport, and he was everywhere that he went, especially in Europe, he was treated like royalty.
That's great.
You know, it was the best. And then, you know, did a bunch of other things, and then to bring this all to culmination here, in 2008, I was hooked up with the Catholic Archdiocese of New York City.
Wow.
And then Pope Benedict XVI was coming into town to hold what they call their Papal Youth Rally. We called it Pope Stock. Basically, what it was is an event that the Vatican holds every 5 or 6 years, and it's a concert, outdoor concert, with all sorts of groups. Nothing like Kiss.
You bring in Stryper.
understandably, but we had a bunch of, you know, Christian rock bands and the like, and I was actually hired to be the talent coordinator and the stage manager for Pope Benedict XVI.
Oh wow.
And I took the job, even though the pay wasn't what I was used to making. But I took the job specifically so that I could be able to say to everybody, I worked for the demon, and I worked for the Pope.
Right.
Not a lot of folks that could say that. So.
It's a pretty interesting juxtaposition on your resume. You know?
Yeah, my claim to fame, what can I say?
It's pretty cool. So do you get more accolades for working with the Pope or from KISS?
Well, more people know about the KISS thing.
Right.
You know, when people find out that I work for the Pope, then that opens up a whole nother discussion, and we get into a bunch of stuff. I will say that out of all of the shows that I've ever been involved with, that show was the heaviest security ever.
I bet.
Ever. I mean, you got to look at it, and like it or not, when you talk about the Pope, he is one of the five most powerful men on the planet. So we were surrounded with Secret Service, you know, uniformed and plain clothes. There's, you know, secret tunnels behind his throne on stage that leads to a helicopter an eighth of a mile away, minimum distance, and
right.
You know, just all of this stuff that people don't know and don't think about because it's not their gig. They don't need to know it, you know. But
yeah,
just some of the inner workings behind all of these gigs, you know.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool that, I mean, you could start, you know, as a young man working with Dust, and then, you know, eventually you're working with the Pope. I mean, it's a pretty strange career path, you know what I mean? But I'm sure you had a blast.
How about that? Yeah, it was very strange. You know, life is good, man. I'm still here and able to talk about it, and speaking to folks like yourself, and you know, strolling down memory lane, so to speak.
Right.
It really allows me to relive a lot of those moments, man. So. It's really very gratifying, and here again, I gotta thank you and the fans for keeping, you know, guys like myself in your hearts, man. It's greatly appreciated.
Man, you're totally welcome, and we want to thank you for everything you've done for the KISS Army and for everything you've done. And it's great. I want to thank you for coming on, man. It's been really cool.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me, man. Rock and roll.
Oh yeah. All right, KISS Army. Make sure you check out the book. You want to give them that website one more time?
www.theoriginalkisscrew.com.
Right on. Make sure you go out there and get it, KISS Army.
Yeah, Google us. You'll see it. Join us on Facebook. Any questions, submit your artwork, all of that good stuff, man. We want to be inclusive. We want to feel you guys. We're not stars.
I think you are, bro.
Thank you, Johnny.
No problem. Once again, this is Jody Havnot. I'm here with J.R. Smalling. We're going to call this an episode. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Peace!
All right, Kiss Army. That's another episode of Strange Ways going down in the books. We hope you really enjoyed it as much as we did doing it. We always have a good time doing these things, and we hope that you really like listening to them. Thanks again for listening. Stay tuned, and we want to invite you to join us on Podomatic, iTunes, Facebook, Stitcher. Dude, just Google it. You'll find us. Anyways, thanks again for listening, and as Ace might say,
keep on rocking.
Hi Kiss fans, this is J.R. Smalling, and I'm pleased to announce the release of our new book, Out on the Streets, written by me and the other members of the original Kiss crew. This book chronicles the glory days of the hottest band in the land from 1974 to 1976. You'll hear the real tales of what it was like to be on the road with Kiss during those early years. For more information or to purchase, visit our website at www.theoriginalkisscrew.com. That's crew with a K. You wanted the book and you got it! And we hope that you enjoy it.
You wanted the best, you got the best. And if you want the hottest show on Monco Radio, join us in the Kiss Room. The Kiss Room is a monthly radio broadcast celebrating the hottest band in the world. It's your place for all things Kiss and some. For broadcast dates and all information, go to thekissroom.com. The Kiss Room broadcasts live and worldwide on Monco Radio, where music and minds meet.
Kisstory Science Theater, the most civilized.
Yeah.
Oh, f-
oh,
me. Come on.
Respectful.
Just imagine Gene with like a washed up bass. Boom, 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 boom.
And serious.
No, wait.
Excuse me, Bob. You're going to come over and do my album.
Kiss Podcast on the web. Kisstory Science Theater. We bust balls because we care.
Someone, somewhere is needing to hear from you. Someone needing to know that you care. Care enough to give the gift of Podkist. Tell a friend about Podkist today. Download us on iTunes, friend us on Facebook, and rock your ass out. Podkist.
Podkist. Rock City.
What's up, everybody? Joe here from Podkist Rock City. Join me each and every week as I give you my opinion on all the Kiss topics and news of the week. I talk about every era of Kiss with a number of guest hosts from all your favorite Kiss podcasts. Check the show out on iTunes, Podomatic, Stitcher, and YouTube. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Podkist Rock City, your 20-minute Kiss fix.
I'm afraid I've given you all the time I can spare at the moment, my dear. You'll have to come back. Thank you, and goodbye.
I love you. Bye!